Anthony, thank you so much for joining us today.
Anthony Johnson, CEO and founder of Stellium, also the founding partner of Johnson Firm, which is a national class action litigation firm, but also we do a lot of mass tort.
Do you think that it was kind of luck that got you into the mass torts arena so early on?
Once I got into law, like, I never really wanted to be a lawyer, but once I started practicing, I'm like, there's so much shit that's broken here, and it drives me nuts. I just want to be like, let's blow this whole system up. It's broken. Like, let's rebuild it from scratch, you know?
So they'll argue that AI is so powerful that we don't want to disclose it to the general public, but the version of AI that we're seeing is the least dangerous version.
Yep. Yeah, the government ones are insane. I think AI is one of these iPhone moments, and the future is very raw and not very productized yet, but it's about to be. All these PI guys, they're like, I got X6 cash. I want to invest in mass torts. Who's the most trusted guy in space to do it for you, to get you the cheapest cases, put it in the right place, and make sure you track it and get paid? You're not being a lawyer, right? You're being E-Trade.
It's like the stock market of mass torts.
Yeah, so I think that's the future of investing in mass torts.
That's going to become actually publicly traded?
Lawsuits will become securities probably in the next 5 years.
Welcome back to another episode of the CEO Lawyer Podcast. I am your host, Ali Awad, the CEO Lawyer. And today, we've got a treat for you guys. We've got none other than attorney Anthony Johnson, who's got one of the craziest stories I've ever heard. He's considered one of the techiest lawyers in America. And we're going to go into his story here in a little bit and how he became one of the top class action filers in the entire country. And you'd probably think from all the different businesses and all the different endeavors that he's been in, this guy's probably like 75, 80 years old. But Anthony, how old are you, man?
I just turned 40. I'm old now, dude.
Okay, let's go.
Hey, boomer.
You're just in the first third of your life, man. So Anthony, welcome to the show. I would like for you to just kind of introduce yourself a little bit to the audience. Tell them a little bit about where you are today. And then we're going to take it right back to 2010 when this all started.
Yeah, like I said, Anthony Johnson, CEO and founder of Stellium, which is kind of our new company we've created to encapsulate the vision of what we're trying to do as a community and the future of law. Also the founding partner of Johnson Firm, which is a national class action litigation firm, but also we do a lot of mass tort work as well.
So Anthony, you started your firm in 2010 out of Little Rock, Arkansas, or outside of Little Rock. And this was right around the time where there was a, 2008 global recession. People weren't really hiring. But before you even went to law school, before you graduated law school, you were already doing SEO and web work for other attorneys, right? So talk to us a little bit about that. It seemed like you were an entrepreneur before you even became an attorney. What was pre-lawyer Anthony like?
I was a computer engineer undergrad. So, that's where I started. Gamer, hacker, all that kind of stuff. And then I actually got my Series 7 finance right after that because I didn't like the jobs in Little Rock at like Axiom, sitting in a cubicle, Dilbert comics and Cheetos and all that. So I was like, I'm out on that. So I went to, did stockbrokering for a little bit. And then really I ended up going to law school mainly because I thought people would trust me more if I had a law degree. It comes to find out, that's not always
the case. A Wall Street guy, you were like a Wall Street guy or something, and you're like, maybe if I had a law degree instead of a Series 7, maybe I could get people to answer the calls. Is that what it was?
Yeah, I mean, I was young and broke, so I was like, what else can I do to pretend like I'm successful and get trusted?
So I'm going to law school. 27 when you started law school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so you already had careers before you even became an attorney.
Careers is would be a nice way to put it, but yeah, I had some side gigs.
What was your most successful endeavor before you became an attorney?
Selling designer jeans out of the trunk of my car to sorority girls.
No way. Well, how did that business run? What did they get to? What kind of thought are you talking?
We were doing about 800 grand a year.
No way. 800 grand a year selling jeans from the trunk of your car.
Yeah. So it was back on the trend. It was like when Citizens True Religions first started getting like real hot and all the girls were wearing them. So yeah. I was in college freshman year and I saw that and I was like, surely I can find these fucking jeans for less than like $200. So I call all around and I finally get a hold of some guy that was a broker for a boutique. And what he did was he would take the overstock from last season from like Bloomingdale's and he would repackage it and sell it to boutiques. Right. And so I was like, that's awesome. I'm a boutique. Right. So I was like, send me some samples. And that's when I learned, cause I could afford the actual samples. So I sold the samples for my first purchase of jeans. And then
set up that LLC, be like, yo, I'm a boutique. Send me what you got.
Learned a lot about business there. Like, had my first accountant, taxes, and pay, you know. And then I started, it was funny because, well, my wife probably did more sales than I did, actually, because she kind of started doing it too and went around traveling Little Rock. She was my girlfriend at the time. And then I started like saying, well, you know, who wants to help me go watch girls change and ask me if their asses look nice? Like, yeah, easy sales pitch in college, right? So we had like at some point 30 or 40 free labor, you know, just running around doing the shows for us. Yeah, it was an interesting gig. Ended up shutting it down. It got shut down, and this is a good lesson too in business. It got shut down because the guy, what happened was the brands decided it wasn't on brand to sell last season's overstock.
Yeah.
So my supply chain got cut off. The only other option was China, and I was like, I'm not gonna sell that shit and pretend like it's real. And so we had to shut the whole thing down.
And that's probably around the same time when they started doing the outlet stores. So I didn't see many True Religion outlet stores or Nike. Well, they were, Nike had an outlet store for the longest time, but some of these newer companies didn't have outlet stores. But I know there's a huge one in Vegas. That's probably around the time where they decided to stop selling last year's products.
Yeah, that's awesome. Smart. I wonder even if this is how macro I've now learned people get to that level. They might have even been like, let's shut it off, give it the year or two space, reboot it as outlets. You know.
Yeah, anyways, so they have enough inventory.
Corporate guys are smart.
So the crazy thing was, so I was in Italy last year, and I visited the Gucci outlet store in Italy, which is a massive, massive store. What city was it? It might have been outside of Florence.
Florence.
Anyway, yeah, huge, just a massive Gucci store, and I'm talking about every single shoe, every single thing, and in my mind, like, I don't really justify spending $1,000 on a pair of shoes unless it's just something that's incredible quality. But in the outlet stores, they're like $250, $270, and you're actually getting an Italian-made shoe. You know, you go to Macy's and get some crap for like $150. So I figured I could justify it at that point. So I keep all of my, you know, outside luxury shopping until I go once a year to Europe. So I go to this Gucci store, and they were telling me that they sell four times as much as the actual, like the flagship store in Italy. And it's because everyone wants a deal, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a year old or 2 years old, everyone wants a deal. And so I actually had a little side hustle when I was in high school, and it was selling Ralph Lauren polo shirts from the trunk of my car. And I did the same thing. I called around all the different distributors, and you realize the best deals that I was able to find was from the stores that would take in these returns, new merchandise that they couldn't put on the shelves anymore, and they would just liquidate them at any cost, almost to the point where they would just give them away. So I started getting all these different shirts, and the biggest sale was the big pony polos. Like, kids absolutely love those shirts, and I was getting them for like $15 a pop, flipping them like 40 or 50. And yeah, this was my side hustle in high school. And then after that, I started my car audio shop with my brothers, and I became one of the biggest wheel wholesalers in the Southeast for Vossen Wheels. So I was, those relationships with these distributors just continued to expand. And I'd start finding the distributors for car audio, for all sorts of electronics. There was a period where I was selling these air purifiers. There was
I did air purifiers.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Sharper Image.
Yeah. This was like 2004, 2005. Cause I started selling online when I was 9 years old, and I built my first eBay store in like 2000. So I'm about to turn 33. And so I'm like 7 years younger than you, but I feel like we both had similar sort of upbringing. We learned how to basically sell online and do that arbitrage of knowledge early on.
Yeah. And that's so much harder then too. Cause now like Amazon, you can look like what you're saying about the returns and shit. I mean, there's a whole cottage businesses that they bring huge boxes of pallets of like Amazon returns. You can go buy from them. But back then, like it was actually harder to piece it all together. Like there was no marketplace for that. Like dropshippers kind of were starting to come out, like that kind of shit, but they weren't great.
But people weren't using the internet as much as they are now. So I remember in 2005, one of the biggest sort of side hustles that I had was buying electronics, specifically kicker subwoofers, from an auction website called ubid.com. And I would go just resell them on eBay. And so I would order these electronics and they would have these auctions for refurbished subwoofers. And at the time, people didn't really know much about refurbished electronics. They had the same packaging. They had the same sort of warranty. And so I would just take those same items, get them shipped to me, and then I would sell them on eBay. And the wholesale price of these subs was like $250. And I was getting them for like mid to low 70s. And so there was enough to be able to order these. And I remember I would ship them all over the country for like 20 bucks. Everything was just so much cheaper, but people weren't using the internet as much. And that was the arbitrage of knowledge that I had. And I actually paid for my college and law school and all of my expenses up until I started my firm, just from the extra online sales that I had. But I want to know, 2010, you started your law practice, the Johnson firm. Okay. And at when did it click where it's like, hey, I have all this experience in sales and technology and online, you know, digital marketing. When did it click where I should use my digital marketing skills and my online sales skills to translate that into a much, much bigger opportunity? Because I know you said you started the first couple of years just taking whatever cases you could get through the door.
Yeah, it's funny. When you say click, it just made me realize my click's probably different than most people. Because, I was in law school not trying to be a lawyer, really. I was going to get out and not be a lawyer. It just kind of fell in line. I mean, I had my first kid in law school. Everything you're not supposed to do while in law school, like buy a house, get a dog, have a kid, did all that.
The dog is the worst. Yeah, you definitely don't get a dog in law school.
Yeah. Well, I had a kid in the NICU too for a while. My first semester, like I remember reading my contracts books with like the heart monitors going off and stuff. I mean, it was, it was a lot, and going to night classes and working full time and all that. So, by the time I got out of law school, I had already built all the personal injury guys websites in the state, with our managed services and website company. And when I got out, there was nobody hiring. So it was really more of a matter of necessity. I was like, well, how am I unique to the market? I know how to rank on Google, right? So I was like, I got a trick, so let's do that. Was able to do that, get a lot of clients. And then right away, that gave me an advantage, I guess, from every other guy in law school, because of the same job environment. We had like 50 guys start law firms, at a law school. And I think maybe one or two, ended up still have a law firm today,
Yeah. I think that's about right. I think from the people that I graduated law school with, I'd probably say there's about 50 of them that ended up starting firms. And I think it might be a little bit easier to start a firm now with social media and technology. But in terms of, scaling and getting to a decent size, you're going to be self-employed for a very long time unless you learn how to scale and add more people, build systems, technology. And I think some people are more infatuated with owning a business and the ego of your own schedule versus the actual financial advantage of working for someone else or building the business. But you kind of did it out of necessity. You started your business because people weren't hiring. Everyone was just starting their own practice. And then something changed around 2012, 2013 with your neighbor. What happened?
Yeah. So I was doing pretty much anything. One of my first cases ever, actually, I got paid $800. It was the oldest case ever to be active in Pulaski County, which is Little Rock, 40 years old. It was a 40-year-old case. And the guy came up to me and he was like, I got $600. It was like my buddy's friend. It's old dude, super nice dude. And he was just like, I need help. I'm getting screwed. I clerked at Rose Law Firm, which has been on like Saturday Night Live. Like Hillary Clinton used to work there. It's very prestigious, like highbrow law firm here. And he said it was against them. I was like, all right, fine. Like I know all those guys. And so there's only really one cause of action that I can argue. And it was fraud and inducement, because you can actually get away with any of the tolling and whatnot. Because you got, at least in Arkansas, it was the only case the only law I could find to like try to argue the case. I get there, and this just goes back to like how hard it is to start practicing law. I remember when I was going to court, I called my buddy up and I'm like, a couple years older than me. I was like, all right, so I got this hearing coming up. Like, what am I supposed to do? And he's like, oh, it'll be fine. No, it'll be there. You and the judge. I'm like, no, you don't hear my question. Should I turn left or like right when I get there? And like, how many copies do I need of things? Like basic things that I was like, I need you to dumb this down.
Do I say
down.
Your
like,
honor or do I call him your highness? Yeah. What do I do here?
No, for real. Like judge, your honor, like whatever,
May I approach the bench?
And then I get to court. And the funny part was, it's now a criminal court. So it's no longer, they don't have tort cases or anything. It's all criminal. So I get the chain gang, the prosecuting attorneys. I have 50 people in the audience for my oral argument against the prestigious law firm where the main partner I was clerking for comes in and very well respected. I got the judge to think about it. We lost, but
was this the first trial you had?
First ever.
Okay. So I kind of have a similar story. I decided that right out of law school, I just needed to learn personal injury. And the exact moment that I decided to become a personal injury lawyer was I went to this seminar that's hosted by this prestigious law firm in Atlanta. And they would bring all the top litigators and trial attorneys, and they would talk about their most recent verdicts and settlements. And this, you know, little black guy with a, you know, mustache and big teeth and afro came up, kind of looked like Eddie Murphy, like in some of his old 80s and 90s, came up and started talking about this case that he was working on. He says, yeah, you know, it was a very serious case. We had to overcome these issues. And, you know, the client had some really serious injuries. And then, you know, he explained the entire situation. Then at the very end, someone at the back of the room raised their hand and said, hey, what was the verdict? He was like looking down, smiling, was like, $7 million. And, you know, I grew up in sales, specifically retail sales. So I could calculate sales taxes. I can do multiplication, addition pretty quickly. I'm thinking 7 million, 40%, 2.8 million. That's a lot of money. And like the moment that clicked with me, right after that, he proceeded to say, but this was in a very difficult venue. It was a very conservative venue. We had a similar case with the same exact fact pattern in a different venue that got a $20 million verdict. And that just blew my mind that this dude right here just made over $10 million in fees over the course of like 2 months, more money than I'd ever seen or my family's ever seen in our entire lives. And this was in like second year of law school when I'm like getting my MBA at the same time, interning at two different jobs, running my car audio stereo shop with my brothers on the nights and weekends, and then selling some Elf audio amplifiers on eBay just to get by. And this dude just made $10 million. So I decided at that point, I'm going to cut everything else out. Everything. And by the way, at that time, I also bought an apartment complex while I was in law school using credit cards. I figured out how to maximize my credit cards and get balance transfers. So you can apply to all these different credit cards that have a 0% balance transfer up to 18 months. You only have to pay a 3 or 4% fee for the balance transfer fee. So I took all this cash up front, bought the apartment complex, and then kept opening new credit cards as they got to the maturity date to payroll sort of the repairs and the maintenance and everything else. And I decided, okay, I'm going to cut everything that I'm doing and just focus 100% on PI. So when I graduated, JD, MBA, I was one of the youngest grads in Georgia State history. I was not, you know, number two or number three in my class. I mean, I was in the top half, but it was good enough to just get by. And I took a job making 40 grand a year as an associate attorney. And I stayed there for 14 months. I learned the entire game of personal injury. And I would have stayed there if they would have actually paid me my bonuses and kept the promises that they made to me. Like I was generating my own cases, working up my own files. And after 14 months, you learn enough if you're willing to work. Now, needless to say, I wasn't making enough money to survive. So I still had a tax business that I ran, you know, on the side with my cousins. And then on the weekends, I would go to the flea market and sell electronics or anything else that I could just to be able to make a little bit of money. So when I finally quit February of 2017, like you can imagine how hungry I've been for all this time. And I had been underpaid and undervalued as an associate. And I was building my social media following. I probably had like 30,000 followers at the time between like Snapchat and Instagram. Snapchat was still really, really big at that time. All through law school, I was recording all of my travels and any new thing I learned in law school, I would share it with my audience. And it just went from February 2017 to starting my firm to February 2018, became a millionaire. And I had to make the decision by 2019, whether I wanted to just have a really good paying job. Like I could make seven figures for myself personally every year, maybe with a couple of assistants and that's it. And I would manage all the cases myself, or if I wanted to actually build a company that would run on its own. And I made the decision that I would learn how to hire and build the systems and the operations and everything else. Cause you know, marketing and sales is just one aspect of it. And people look at me and think, well, you know, you have this social media presence. It should be very easy for you. It's not though. There are people with 10 times the amount of followers that I have that are not even close to the kind of revenue that we generate because they don't know the business side. And so I had to struggle a little bit in the beginning to kind of, you know, learn how to hire. I made a lot of mistakes and I'm still making mistakes to this day, but it was well worth it for me to look at, you know, 5 years in, the company is running on its own and now I don't have to really be as involved. But it's always been in the back of my mind that mass torts is a much bigger opportunity than these single event cases. And, you know, you mentioned that you had, you know, you were, and we're going to talk about the story of your, you know, your neighbor had this serious injury and then you started calling these different law firms. But do you think that it was kind of like luck that got you into the mass torts arena so early on? Or do you think you could have very easily ended there, just kind of in the natural progression of the way your mind works? Or do you think if you would have had a big settlement in the PI practice, you would have just been, you know, the big slinger in Arkansas as a PI practice? Like, what do you think actually happened?
Yeah. So, I mean, I look at luck and I know people have said this, it's really like being prepared and then seeing the opportunity. Like if you don't prepare, you don't work your ass off, like you're never going to see it. So people describe that as luck. I just look at it like the more prepared you are, the more you're able to identify the luck when it comes across your table. So yeah, there was luck involved, obviously, on the timing of it, but would I have gotten there? Sure. I'm just not the kind of person, like I'll keep lifting over the stones until I figure out what's going on. You know, it's just the engineer in me, or just curious, I guess, to a fault. And especially like once I got into law, like I never really wanted to be a lawyer, but once I started practicing, I'm like, there's so much shit that's broken here and it drives me nuts. And it's just my personality. I just want to be like, let's blow this whole system up. It's broken. Like, let's rebuild it from scratch, you know, make it better. And so like, I mean, even since I was filing cases where a guy was like, oh, my email girl comes in on Mondays. And I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? You know? And then the guy's trying to make me like fax him shit and mail him shit and email him. And because he can't get his mail. And I'm like, this is breaching an ethical issue on you. Like, you can't just stop learning shit because you're old. Like, you know, that's costing your clients and me and everybody. I filed like a 27 fucking page motion for sanctions. I was you know, ambitious young lawyer. But anyways, yeah. So yeah, luck's involved. Obviously it was and the timing of me getting involved. And then just, you know, the moment where I stopped and focused was less in personal injury. And it was more in, I had done a lot of tech startups and like TechCrunch stuff and Y Combinator, like applications and had all that stuff going on. I shut all that down when I got out of law school, but I didn't know what practice area I wanted to do. I wanted PI, but the likelihood I got a good PI case in Arkansas, also not good. Like, you know, also the likelihood of me becoming the best trial lawyer, which means getting that case early and scaling up and then getting involved in bigger cases and like becoming this Mark Lanier type guy, you know, like zero chance. Like, it's not fucking happening.
Also, I do want to give value to the people that are listening here, because I think you think a lot faster than most people do. And I want to just break this down a little bit. So you looked at your current situation, you realized, hey, Arkansas is a population of 3 million people. You looked at, hey, I'm in a PI practice. There is a likelihood of making money, but the statistical probability of me landing a great PI case with the people that we have here and getting it early enough to kickstart my career and build a reputation for becoming a trial attorney, the probability is just way too low for it to even make sense. So do you think if you were in a city like New York City, 20 million people, do you think it would have been different?
For me, I think yes, because of my background in SEO and digital marketing, web design, all that early on. Like, you know, I was so early, like people were teaching the algorithms of Facebook and Google, you know, for small windows. So in those cities, yeah, I mean, there's the market demand, and then it's about being better at the actual skill of marketing. I can win that game all day. But when there's literally just no one that calls you, like, you know, I'll get the nickel and dime ones, but yeah, we don't have operational leverage to make that efficient. And then and we know this now, I didn't know this then, but the whales and the round twos are typically referrals, or they tend not to come from the direct consumer click ads or whatever. There's more to it than that. And so, yeah, it would have taken a miracle for me to get a case that could have given me that shot, you know, that boost in the arm to actually scale something that mattered. In New York, I'm thankful for it, because in New York, like, I probably would have gotten more cases, been able to narrow down the focus of my practice, pivoted into PI, and you know, to your credit, I could have made some money and be like, okay, I'll just do this, you know. Maybe not though. I'm not that kind of person. But you know what I'm saying? Like, I might have ended up anchoring more and being a trial lawyer instead of trying to get more creative on saying, well, how can I expand my reach or my skill set on a more national scale?
So walk me through the time your neighbor had this serious injury and how you got into mass torts from this, what people might call luck, but it was really more where preparation meets perspiration.
Yeah. The neighbors, so we end up getting a tall building. You know, there's not very many in Little Rock, but you know, in my head, I thought that was what success looked like. And I partnered with a couple guys, and I was kind of like you, where to your point, like lawyers have a hard time valuing business gen, like biz dev. And I remember all my interviews after law school where I was like, yeah, they're like partner tracks, like 7 years and, you know, like defense companies and all that. And I'm like, well, what if I bring in like millions of business? And they just kind of laugh, you know? Yeah.
It doesn't work like that here.
Yeah. Nobody does that. Like, I now realize it is harder to bring in insurance companies and shit, but you know, still, whatever. It's just funny to me that we don't really encourage that as a community, as an industry. But yeah, so I got a guy and I was with a couple partners that were doing random things, bankruptcy and other stuff that they wanted me to pull me in because I referred them so much business. They had like a Yellow Pages ad right when it was going away. And I'm like, I'm not signing on that note. Like if I come on, but I was like doing all the operations and the infrastructure and the, you know, this is when I got the America's Techiest Lawyer Award by the ABA in 2012. And it was because I was completely on the cloud, which I was like, this is the bar for top 10 techiest lawyers in America. It was like the cover story. I was like, this is baffling. But yeah, so the guys next to me, they were just super bros, like Bowflex. They'd have like a 30 pack on the ground. You know, they were IT headhunters. And one of the guys, and so I'd go over and just shoot the shit with them, you know. And then one of the guys finally was like, threw a recall letter of a metal hip product he had. And it's like a 45-year-old guy, like pretty young, yeah. Played rugby and all this other stuff. But he had two metal hips and both of them were actually bad. Different brands. And so I just started Googling it. I found some huge firms that were willing to take it on. It was an interesting dynamic because it's the first time I had a case that tons of huge firms really wanted. And so when I just called these people and I called the top 10 guys on Google, you know, which goes to show what people like to do, including lawyers for referrals. And so they just started kind of, you know, bidding against each other. Like, I'll do this much, or I'll give you 20%, 25, 30%, whatever. And so once I saw that, I found out the value of it. And that was the moment I realized I like the practice area for this one reason. From a digital standpoint, if you're trying to compete on like personal injury, on like SEO, right? You have all these people with this history of news stories, and you know, you've got those hometown hero guys that have been marketing for a long time. And it's hard to compete on Google when you have that, even when you're hacking, you know, trying to like, yeah, you know, game the system.
Black hat, all that stuff.
Yeah, I like gray hat, but yeah, black, probably black hat back then because you get away with it. So I was like, you know, it's hard to compete in PI, like you got to catch up. And I built those guys' sites, so like I know. So when I saw this, I was like, this is a tort with a similar economics, if not better, but it's more of like an industrialization of the tort market where it's a repeatable, it consolidates the players. And the best part about it is that you hit go at the same time. So no one knew talcum powder had a link to ovarian cancer until it started.
Exactly.
So when you put me in a situation where we start at the same time as other lawyers against digital marketing, I'm going to win.
Yeah.
Every time. So like, that's when I was like, that's my advantage. This is the play to get in. It's national. So I completely took my whole docket, hired a young associate, gave it all to him. That this is yours now. He ended up also handling our trust stuff and our, you know, some of our like random business we got for cash flow. And then I found one of the firms that was like, hey, you know, because my negotiation was, I've got 7 cases because I wrote a blog. I told you just now that there's a local doctor that ended up serendipitously being one of the biggest volume striker orthopedic surgeons in the state. Yeah. And he was like 4 miles from my house. It's a pretty funny story. Once I found that out though, I actually went and this is kind of the entrepreneur, like, who cares? Let's see if I can do it kind of thing. And you know, that we both described, but it was this one driveway from an elementary school tucked in the back and the ortho clinics there. Right. And it's like commercial lots. And I was like, how can I market to these people? And I was like, so I called the ones for sale, the lots. And I was like, hey, can I pay you $500 a month to put a temporary like billboard on your lot, strike on the way into the ortho clinic? So I built a temporary like 5x7 billboard, got a vinyl, I wrapped it, I put it up. Striker recall, call me. It made news. I think he knew someone in the waste management services that would take it down every few days. And I was like getting deer cameras to try to like catch who was taking my signs down.
Full-on investigative role now.
Oh, it became a war. I FOIA'd the fucking government. I was like, I want to see these emails. I bet somebody's pulling some strings, you know? So it was pretty fun. I did that, got some cases. And then because I wrote a blog and I got 5 or 6, I kind of went back to the firms before I sent them. And I was like, hey, now I have more. If I refer them to you, I know there's value. You just told me they're worth $250,000 a piece or whatever is your estimation. And like you, I did the math, like, you know, and so I was like, well, would you give me some money to get you some more if I send you these cases? So it's already a wash for them. Like worst case scenario, I sent them a ton of money. So they gave me $50,000, wanted like 20 cases, ended up using that to get another 170 some cases for them. And
wow, all of the striker recall.
Found out later that there was a lot more hips. So, and nobody knew what kind of hip they had. So you advertise for metal hips, then you would do like a product ID on a, you know, medical request. So ended up getting about maybe 30% on the striker side, but anyone in striker would take all the hips. Like, you know, they just didn't know it yet. They were just getting the mass works too.
And this was in 2013?
2013.
And so you ended up with close to a couple hundred cases of these hip replacement.
Yep.
And when did they actually settle or come into fruition? Did it all happen at once, or do they kind of like piece by piece?
First payment probably didn't come for 4 or 5 years. I'm still getting paid on a set of active cases in hips now.
So, I mean, people that want to get into mass sorts should not think of a instant gratification game at all.
People say 3 to 5 years. I think it's more like 4 to 7.
Yeah, I actually haven't met too many people that actually got paid on their mass torts. There's a handful of people that kind of get paid, but it seems like most in the industry are just in the client acquisition game. And then there's a couple of big firms that are handling it. So what do you think the current market is for mass torts? Do you think it still makes sense for people to compete in mass torts on a national level? Or do you think the approach that you took 10 years ago was, hey, find these sort of local mass torts instead of like a massive class action that's national, find local mass torts that fall under your state guidelines and just litigate those in-house?
There's a few places you can do that. Medical device and drug mass torts tend to not be localized. Environmental, you can look at like that way. Privacy claims, like so one of the earliest litigations I got into was Exxon oil spill case. And I look at those like a mini mass torts, essentially, yeah. Like localized ones. It was actually in our backyard. It was one of the first oil spills that like ran down a residential street. And I actually got all that business with a tweet, which was kind of funny. So we did a lot of that. We did a lot of like SWAT marketing, like event-based and kind of crisis type marketing, but it's different. So I would say it's different now because one, it's been years since I've actually seen an MDL fully go through as an MDL, like create a matrix settlement and settle. What defense is now doing is like breaking everyone up and taking all the steering committee guys and like ripping them out of the MDL. So the whole system is broken. But I guess the simple answer to the question is, I think there's two ways to look at this. And most people look at it the wrong way, which is, should I get into mass torts, right? So they think about investing this money, but they're not acting like an investor when they like throw an investment at mass torts. They're acting like a lawyer. So they're saying, I'm going to take my advertising budget, go get cases, bring them into my CRM and try to do mass torts. Like, that's never been a good idea. You know, that's bad for the litigation. It's bad for a lot of reasons. I think you should really ask yourself, are you going to be a mass tort lawyer? And should you be, right? So if you're going to do it like that, that's your question. And then the other way to say is like, how do I act as an investor and not a lawyer? So if you're going to buy these cases, like, well, who's getting them for you and who's putting them at the right firm and how am I maximizing value to the client and myself, almost whether it's through like a portfolio manager, which is kind of the idea of something we're working on now as a product, which is all these PI guys, they're like, I got XX cash. I want to invest in mass torts. Okay, well, find who's the most trusted guy in space to do it for you, to get you the cheapest cases, put it in the right place and make sure you track it and get paid. you're not being a lawyer, right? You're being E-Trade or whatever.
Yeah. It's like the stock market of mass torts.
Yeah, so I think that's the future of investing in mass torts. And if you want to be a lawyer doing mass torts.
Do you think that's going to become actually publicly traded?
Do I think? Yeah, I mean, I think lawsuits will become securities probably in the next 5 years.
That's interesting because a lot of people are freaking out about the whole Arizona private equity buying into firms. But that also, it's a double-edged sword because the same way that private equity can kind of get into firms, you also can open it up to the general public in terms of lawsuits becoming securities. And now the general public can invest in law firms and have equity in the cases that they work up versus you using outside capital. Because the real problem is the funding companies. They're making so much money off of like people's misfortunes. And it started with the cash advance companies that have been around for 20, 30 years, and they'll charge 100% interest. And then there's the litigation finance companies that start getting really, really high interest rates. Some of them are already, you know, in bed with a DC firm where they'll have like, you know, a percentage of equity in your cases. And a lot of times it's a sharky deal. You know, you're getting these ridiculously high interest rates. But if you position it more as a security where it's an investment for the general public, and the public can now invest in protecting consumers by investing their dollars the same way they buy a stock of Apple, they could buy shares in this mass tort against this massive multi-billion dollar conglomerate. I feel like that actually evens the playing field.
Yeah, I would say that there's a huge difference on litigation funders versus, you know, the J.G. Wentworth, you know, the plaintiff funders. I mean, those guys are definitely predatorial on the consumers, right? And they're the ones that know the least. Now, guys that are litigation finance guys, they're backing law firms, and sure, may it have a negative effect on like the litigation or the landscape or what the lawyer does, maybe. But I don't think it hurts the consumers. If anything, I think the money now comes with regulation and oversight, because that's what they're used to in the finance world. And so what's happening now isn't that Wall Street's fucking with everybody and messing up the marketplace. It's just highlighting problems that we clearly have. Yeah. Like, you know, like you guys lost all my money. Well, they were a terrible operating business. Like that's a problem for clients, right? So like, as more and more money comes in the market, they're going to hold all business to a new standard, which is going to benefit the consumer in the end. But this is just the process of getting there. You're going to see a lot more shit come out before it fixes things.
What do you think about the companies that their entire business model is taking investments from other lawyers, PI lawyers, to invest in various mass tort campaigns? And they basically scalp a 10-15% management fee off the top end, off the front end, and then take, you know, a percentage of the attorney's fee on the back end. That's their entire business model. Do you think that industry has a likelihood of consolidating, or is it going to become fragmented like PI, where there's just going to be a bunch of people all competing to get investors? Because if I get a pool of five different lawyers and say, hey, you guys each give me $100,000 and I'll start investing. I got 2 million followers on social media. I make a couple of posts. We get together. We partner up with these other firms. I mean, where do you think it's going to end up?
I think that gets consolidated and goes away. There's already a trend right now. I mean, you know, there's, I think it was like $5 billion invested in the market in litigation finance last year. I mean, it's insane. It's growing at like a 20-30% clip. It's pretty, it's huge. But when you talk to the guys behind the guys, once you peel the onion back, and there's not many of them, maybe 4 or 5 guys that really control the whole thing. And you realize that this whole exercise of deploying these $5 billion a year, $3 billion a year before was just learning. Like, that's how fucking big Wall Street is. And so what they're realizing is like those guys add no value to the process. So now they're like, well, should we either build it ourselves, like a QA shop, like a QA process, or like the marketing and aggregation side? Should we? They're just testing the waters on how to like turn this fragmented, dated market into a more enterprise type, you know, environment. And so those guys, as soon as you realize like, how do they create value once you have a single place where you can just put all your money in, you can guarantee the requirements and the case criteria and the price points and all that and pay no fee. Like, it's, you know, it's the easiest thing to commoditize is marketing and advertising. Like, it's a business that's been around forever.
Do you think the predictability of mass torts could ever get to a point where you give me an investment, I can give you a 4 to 6% return on your money, almost like, you know, a bank account, savings account, and then that's basically your ROI. And then once we've 3x or 4x, then you can get, you know, any sort of extra dividend. And do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, that's a no-brainer. I think the reason why Litfin is overpriced right now is because it's an emerging market. I mean, like the same guys that were doing Uber and WeWork, like Benchmark Capital and Fortress, like the same guys doing Litfin. Like it's the same to them. It's just, how do we get alpha, you know, on emerging markets? And if they're willing to give the 20% loans, it means the asset is underpriced and there's lack of capital. So as we get standardization, you end up, and they also feel very comfortable in getting paid back. So yeah, the idea of having a derivative type environment where you can actually do investments or ETFs or mutual funds and get higher than bond returns. Yeah. And, you know, and it's the asynchronous to the market. So it's a good diversification for investors, consumers. So yeah, I think after standards, I mean, you'll have like ETF products that are institutional.
Who do you think are there any current players that are best positioned to create an ETF style product?
That will be the Goldmans. They're not. So what the irony here is, like, the guys that you hear of that are doing this stuff, they're nobodies compared to the Goldman Sachs and the $1 trillion huge players. So once it becomes a security, it then gets out of the emerging market space, which is the funds you hear about, into like big boy, you know, commodities and stocks. And
then at that point, it's safe to say you probably can't compete.
I mean, you can go invest on NASDAQ or
whatever. Yeah. So let me ask you this. You know, there's speculation, and, you know, I'm sure it has some truth to it, that major real estate institutions like BlackRock use artificial intelligence to sort of predict trends in the real estate market. And they've been using these really highly powerful AI tools for decades. Hasn't been given out to the public. They've been using this to understand the shift in real estate markets and kind of take advantage before anyone else could. And that's how they became, you know, $10 trillion assets under management. Where do you think AI will play a role in the mass torts client acquisition, valuing these types of claims? Is there a tool out there that already does something like this? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of attention to what's going on with ChatGPT, OpenAI. I don't know if you read the letter a few weeks ago where they basically called for like a moratorium on all AI, like the...
I saw it. It was some of the wealthiest people. And I think it's... So they'll argue that AI is so powerful that we don't want to disclose it to the general public. But the version of AI that we're seeing is the least dangerous version.
Yep. Yeah, the government ones are insane. So anyways, I say all that to say that is anything in the market in use right now for this? Not really. And the reason is because all AI, especially large language models like ChatGPT, they're built on a corpus of data that has to have structured information. So the idea of reading like SCOTUS reports or something like that, that's even pretty difficult for like an AI to do right now, in order to predict like legal opinion and sentiment changing. And then you look at the legal markets, like where are you going to pull your data from on predicting law firm behavior, like filings and, you know, whether or not something's good. Now, using it on the marketing front for like a PI, like you pulling in traffic data and, you know, those kind of things, income data, and using big data for marketing. I mean, marketing tends to be the earliest adopter because that's where a lot of the money is and the budgets are. So I spent a lot of money and time and lost a lot of money and time over COVID looking into like huge data companies and how they might integrate with marketing. I think marketing's getting a lot more difficult because of it. Because with all the money coming in, mass sorts, PI will be next, by the way, but mass sorts for now, because it's just more simple to wrap their heads around. But with all this money, and you look at that Camp Lejeune that came out, right? And everyone's seen the ads by now. But before then, like Mizo, maybe 30, 40 million a year, like total ad spends. And Camp Lejeune's chunked out $500 million across like 6 months because all this capital is starving to come in. And so when you do that, like you can't just run Facebook ads, like they've run out. You can't just run Google ads, like you kind of start capping out. So then what the marketers have to do is now go to like Remnant and Trade Desk and like all this stuff that's real shitty quality type volume and traffic. And then that's where like AI and DSPs and like these more technical demand side platforms, CDPs can come in and make the people that know how to do this on a real enterprise scale much better than all the legal guys out there that have been getting away with, you know, being good marketers that happen to know about the law and not just being the best marketers in the world.
Have you heard of this company called Truvy? So it's an AI powered dashboard that basically combines all of your software systems and utilizes the different dashboards from like your phone calling dashboard, your case management dashboard, your finance dashboard, everything to give you kind of trends and predictions in your data. And like whenever I talk about it, I feel like people don't even realize that this is a possibility. And I think the same way that real estate agents got decimated over the past 5 years, I think every industry where there's massive opportunity for cash with honestly not that much technical knowledge, it's going to be replaced. Are there any other companies do you think people should be looking into, like, hey, here's a software that I think you should probably look at implementing into your firm? It's going to get you at least a step ahead and continue on that growth trajectory.
Yeah. So I call it True, but is it Truvy? I've never actually talked to them. That company, everyone says the words AI, but I don't think AI when I think of these companies. Like, to me, that's like business intelligence. That's a huge trend lately. Like, everyone's talking about data. Everyone's talking about like knowing your numbers and shit, but like it's kind of a blue ocean right now with legal. Like, who's offering an actual solution for this? We spend a lot of time. We have a dev company that does a lot of IT managed consulting. We spend a lot of time integrating disparate systems and sucking it all in and translating the data and normalizing it so that these dashboards work. So if you don't have that good, that's the problem with a lot of this, why no one sells it. But any business intelligence tool basically is what I would say, but I say that with like a huge asterisk. I mean, if you don't know what you're doing, I would say find somebody, but again, no one's offers it. And our model to not actually sell it except for to like five people. So,
well, it's kind of like it's a data entry problem first. So a lot of people don't even have a good software system that gives them the opportunity to enter the data. And if they do, they're not entering the data properly. And if they are entering data, then they probably don't have a backup system to make sure that they're, you know, verifying that the information is correct. And you have to have all those things in order before you can use it, because someone still has to input this information in. And until you get a software that's strong enough, and I know with Truvy, they're working on this sort of like OCR on steroids, where you can kind of just input all your documents that you have in Dropbox and it can start pulling all the information and saying, hey, looks like this was a police report, car accident that happened in this county. This person was cited with this much. They went to the emergency room. They had these diagnoses. They recommended this ortho. And at some point, I think you can almost replace the case management aspect of it. That's why a lot of us have virtual assistants, is they're just one step towards automation. But let's talk about 5 years from now. 5 years from now, where do you think the PI landscape is going to be? Now, we saw what happened with Florida with tort reform. Do you think first that that's going to be something that's going to happen nationwide, assuming DeSantis doesn't become president? Or
I think that my same response to the idea of tort reform risk as a macro risk, lawyers are fucking smart. Doesn't matter. I mean, like, sure, there's gonna be tort reform, and I'm pretty sure they're gonna figure out how to still sue people. Like,
yeah.
So I just don't worry about it. I don't think there'll be national tort reform like that. There's too much opposition to it. Anyone that knows the reality of things and anyone that's been through a lawsuit would never vote for it, you know? So I think
it's just going to translate special damages into general damages. That's all it's really going to do is, hey, now you're saying the medical bills can only be worth this much. Okay, well, that doesn't take away my pain. Now, instead of me presenting the meds in trial, I'm going to say, let's just talk general damage. Let's talk pain and suffering about having a hip surgery.
That's it. There's a lot of constitutional arguments about even fee caps that can be made. You can't cap your contractual ability for someone to hire you and to represent you. Like, I know they try to put into state law that, but there's some national constitutional laws I think that lawyers will try to get around a lot of it. So, I'll let those guys work it out.
Well, and I agree with you. I think litigators will figure out a way to make it work. There are too many powerful personal injury attorneys in Florida that are not, they're just not going to take it laying down. But you mentioned earlier that it takes minimum 4 or 5 years for mass torts cases to kind of pan out and pay out. Do you think over the next 5 years, it makes sense for PI lawyers to invest and at least use 5, 10%, whatever number you think is reasonable of their revenues from their PI practice to diversify into mass torts? And how would you go about that if you're advising someone, or if you were a new PI lawyer that is starting right now, 2020, 2023, what percentage of your revenues would you consider investing into mass torts, and how would you go about it?
I would answer it more like a finance guy, probably. I would say, I wouldn't think about it as like a percentage of revenue. I would say, like, what's your practice like right now? And if you were to take the money out personally and invest it in something, would lawsuit be the allocation? And would mass torts be the allocation? Like, your core business is PI. Taking some of that money and investing in mass torts is not like, not your core business at all. It's an investment in a totally different business, just because it's legal, to, you know?
So, huge difference though in using pre-tax dollars versus post-tax dollars. I think that's the biggest
play. I'm talking about mindset though, not literally. So sure, you want to use pre-tax dollars to go invest in something. Well, what can you afford to invest in? Like, and also invest like Jimmy Buffett in this regard. Like, you know, if you can't afford to hold it for 10 years, don't hold it for 10 seconds. Yeah. So you just know what you're getting into, allocate it based on your ability to allocate, but assume it's gone and locked for a long time. Because there's no, right now, because it's not a commodity, you can't buy and sell this thing. It's yours, and no one's going to trust it later to give you cash for it, like, because they're going to assume you just fucked it up since the moment you got it, and they don't have any clue on what marketer gave it to you and what your QA process was. So it's yours forever.
So you think it basically your risk tolerance should
be, how much money do you have? Do you have liquid capital? Do you never need the money? Is it not going to affect your core business? And whatever's left over, do whatever you want with it.
Have you seen the, there's an emerging trend in mass torts against concert venues where people get injured or killed, and, you know, because of negligence in security and maintenance. Do you feel like those are going to become more prevalent, or that's just experimentation still, like it's too early to tell?
Yeah, those, I mean, you got the guy like the Vegas shootings that are huge, right? And they became actual MDLs. And then you have stuff like New Orleans balconies falls or clubs like that, which those are actually, if you can compete in those, like locally, those are great ones to get into, because you can actually, there's less people in it, mostly local people in it, local clients. It gives you an advantage on signing them up. I would just recommend, if you're going to get involved as a lawyer, try to get involved with something where you have a, I guess, the least relays to people with decision-making power or leverage. You know, if you get in a big ass MDL that you're working with some guy that's not in the PSC, that's working with some guy, like between you and the defense counsel is like nine chains of command, you know, touch points.
So and if you're going to get into mass torts, make sure you at least have a 1 or 2 degrees of separation maximum from the person that's actually litigating these cases.
Yep. Yep. And sure. And the local ones are great. They're harder to get into, but if you get the opportunity, it just allows you a lot more room to learn and get involved as a lawyer and to have control over what's going on.
So Anthony, I'm glad you took us on this journey of AI and technology and software. But I know you probably get asked a lot of these types of questions over and over again. So I wanted to ask you, what would you have liked for me to ask, or something that I didn't ask that you wish I would have asked you about?
I don't get that question much. What would I have liked for you to ask? I guess I guess I would go with what, you asked me a lot of things, whether or not they should do things, I guess. I guess the more open-ended question of kind of what do I think that the future entails and where I would go if I was a PI lawyer, and pay attention to. Because I think I would be different than the questions you specifically asked. I would say that with all the money coming in from Wall Street and with the idea of them wanting to standardize things, a few things that I think everyone should look into, which is like enterprise technology. So if you're using a CRM that's homegrown or home baked, or even some of these small products, if it's not an enterprise, you're not going to position yourself well should there be a day where they are conglomerating and they're looking to buy people up. Like, they're going to look at that. They're going to look at your tech stack. Like, Salesforce is obviously just a big enterprise platform. Like, that's a checkbox easily if they're trying to acquire you. If you're trying to retire, like, that's the other thing. Like, through consolidation, there's gonna be a lot of change of guard, what's going on. And then the other part is, Yeah. I mean, invest like an investor, or if you're going to be a lawyer, make sure you can afford to expand your practice areas. And if you're going to get into mass torts, like don't pretend like you can do mass torts unless you can, and actually learn from someone that knows how to do it. So that would kind of be my, I guess, my advice with the shifting landscape.
So it's funny, you mentioned the saleability of your firm. Essentially, make sure that you're utilizing good technology in your law firm if you want to have the ability to exit and sell it at a decent multiple. What's something that lawyers could do to increase the multiple? Because I think 2.5-3 times EBITDA is probably a typical valuation for a law firm. How do you get to 10, 15, 30X multiple on your law firm? Like what do you think institutional investors would want to see? Because consolidation is coming. Private equity is already here. So you might as well start having a positioning in your business where you could potentially sell it for a high multiple. What would you do in those situations to get that high multiple?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. You know, Archer, they do a settlement administration, pretty big company. They're a services company. So if you looked at them on the face of it and you said they're like a service company with call centers that, you know, did a lot of the lien resolution and whatnot for these big litigations, they may get like a 5, 6x, 7x multiple on their EBITDA. If you look at them like a tech company where they have technology and platform and IP and everything like that, they probably got bought at I think it's public with Fortress, maybe 13x or more. So they doubled their EBITDA because they spent a lot of money on infrastructure. And so to the same point, if you're going to sell your law firm, I mean, right now the 2-3x is coming from the fact they go, okay, so all I'm buying is a book and it's going to just slowly die. Like that's how they're valuing the 2-3x. So you got to give them something else to buy. Like, are they buying your process and your infrastructure and your, you know, the brand, even if you can actually grow it. But I think the easiest one would be infrastructure. So do you have infrastructure that allows you to connect to a law firm and be a, like more like a merger? Or are they just going to buy you to buy your book and sunset your career? Cause that's what they're going to discount. So, repeatable processes, great technology infrastructure. And then, a business that can survive without you, like you said, because right now I think they just assume none of them can.
Awesome. Anthony, thank you so much for giving us your insight today and giving us your time. I hope that we could call you back at some point. And I do want to go more into the selling of law firms and just kind of how technology is going to impact the sellability and the consolidation of firms. Is there anything else you want to tell the audience before we let you go today?
Yeah, despite what all I said, I think AI is one of these iPhone moments, and the future is very raw and not very productized yet, but it's about to be. And so you better be paying attention to it. Whether it's using CoCounsel, which is the new product by Casetext, smart dudes building that, leveraging OpenAI, or using AI transcription tools, or, you know, OCR and all that. So it's going to move fast, and that's going to give you a huge advantage if you can be a first mover on AI as it comes out.
Awesome. You heard it from the man himself, guys. Make sure that you're utilizing AI. Take a look at these companies like CoCounsel and Truvvi and these companies that are leveraging AI for your law firm. Anthony, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll see you all on the next CEO Lawyer Podcast show. Thank you all for joining. See you on the next one.